Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Sunday through Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Who's Reading the Organon, a show hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook. She invites you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts as we complete reading Samuel Hahnemann's Organon. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, taking time out in the day to begin with some inspiration, to talk a little bit about some current events, and to read the words of Dr. Samuel Hahnemann in his Organon of Medicine. Today is October 11th, Columbus Day, 2010, and you're listening to show number 110. Thanks for joining me. I would like to remind everyone that this is a study session and listeners must consult their healthcare provider. Don't forget to click on listen, friend, favorite, and comment on the Blog Talk Radio, Who's Reading the Organon. Also, I will start with the inspiration tip for today from Deborah Ulrich of Twitter, who says, Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492. And that's for the spirit of exploration, adventure, daring, and going into the unknown on this marvelous, bright Columbus Day. And I would also like to give a shout out to my over 10,000 Twitter followers and to all of the over 2,000 Homeopathy World Community members. Remember, you can listen to the show at any time. On Facebook, Shilpa Harwani has posted a quote, four things you can't recover, the stone after the throw, the word after it said, the occasion after it's missed, the time after it's gone. And on a personal note, I just flew home from a quick weekend trip to Utah to attend a wedding, a celebration, a time of joy and communion. So it was a good thing I didn't miss that. And also, I just got word this morning that our uncle, who was just about 95 years old, passed quietly in his sleep last night. And we were very sorrowful to hear this type of news. And then Shilpa's words really hit home, hit my heart as very, very meaningful. And I wanted to understand where these words came from, whether it was a famous quote or whatever, where it started from. And this is something that happens on the internet, that words are passed around, thoughts have meaning. And I searched and searched, and the earliest that these words came were in 2007. Through emails, and you know how those emails can go viral. And this is what it said. A young lady was waiting for her flight in the boarding room of a big airport. As she would need to wait many hours, she decided to buy a book to spend her time. She also bought a packet of cookies. She sat down in an armchair in the VIP room of the airport to rest and read in peace. Beside the armchair, where the packet of cookies lay, a man sat down in the next seat and opened his magazine, started reading. When she took out the first cookie, the man took one also. She felt irritated, but she said nothing. She just thought, what a nerve. If I was in the mood, I would punch him for daring. For each cookie she took, the man took one too. This was infuriating her, but she didn't want to cause a scene. When only one cookie remained, she thought, ah, what does this abusive man do now? Then the man, taking the last cookie, divided it into half, giving her one half. That was way too much for her. She was much too angry now. In a huff, she took her book, her things, and stormed to the boarding place. When she sat down in her seat inside the plane, she looked into her purse to take her eyeglasses. And to her surprise, she found her packet of cookies was there, untouched and unopened. She felt so ashamed, she realized that she was wrong. She had forgotten that her cookies were kept in her purse. The man had divided his cookies with her without feeling angered or bitter. While she had been very angry, thinking that she was dividing her cookies with him, and now there was no chance to explain herself nor to apologize. The moral of the lesson of that story was, there are four things you cannot recover: the stone after the throw, the word after it is said, the occasion after the loss, the time after it's gone. And I just wanted to deliver that message to anyone who's listening to make life a little bit more meaningful and to bring some inspiration to us all. Going a little bit further, I would like to say that Dr. Shreya's Homeopathy has also posted a blog, a little short thing on Facebook. Dr. Shreya is a brilliant and outspoken homeopath who is also a good Twitter friend. She says, the child that raises the most surprising objection to whatever is asked to be done may be argentum nitricum. And so for those people who are not familiar with homeopathy, that is a homeopathic remedy made from silver nitrate. And she says more information. She says that Kent gives this observation of him in his Materia Medica, the book of like an encyclopedia of remedies. To give an example, she says, I had a child patient who used to keep disturbing when his mother used to tell me about his condition. On this observation, I had prescribed lycopodium, another remedy, for his digestive disturbances initially. He also had a sweet craving and flatus, but he improved only partially. Then I saw in the next couple of follow-ups that it was his habit to do so. Not only disturbing, but he used to ask questions that sounded peculiar. For example, once he asked me while I was typing something on the computer about his condition, Dee Dee, does your son also have this kind of gastric trouble? That was quite unusual for a child of 3 years old to ask. When I answered no, he said, then why didn't you give me the medicine that you gave him not to develop that? Though this is not what exactly the comment says, the questions are peculiar. No need to say a single dose of that argentum nitricum cured the child completely of his recurrent gastric problems. And I'm looking forward to a continuation of this conversation on Facebook to find out some more examples and maybe make this rubric of questioning a little bit more comprehensive to us so we understand it a little bit more. I'd like to move on a little bit to a opinion piece on CNN. In a previous Who's Reading the Organon show, I spoke to you about a brand new book called White Coat, Black Hat, Adventures on This Dark Side of Medicine, that is authored by Dr. Carl Elliott, an MD and PhD. And he has posted here an opinion piece also on the CNN. And I thought I'd read it to you just to give you an idea of what he's talking about in the book. Quote, if you want to understand the way prescription drugs are marketed today, have a look at the 1928 book entitled Propaganda by Edward Bernays, the father of public relations in America. For Bernays, the public relations business was less about selling things than about creating the conditions for things to sell themselves. When Bernays was working as a salesman for a Mozart piano, for example, He did not simply place advertisements for pianos in the newspaper. That would have been too obvious. Instead, Bernays persuaded reporters to write about a new trend. Sophisticated people were putting aside a special room in the home for playing music. Once a person had a music room, Bernays believed, he would naturally think of buying a piano. As Bernays wrote, quote, it will come to him as his own idea. So you're listening a little bit to this opinion piece on CNN, and it's true that sales and marketers are trying to put into the minds of those who are going to be purchasing an item as if it's their brilliant idea, that this is something that they need, something that they want, whether it is true or not. And so he's putting into place the idea that selling is something that is being done to us by the pharmaceutical companies. Let's read a little bit more on here. It says, just as Bernays sold pianos by selling the music room, pharmaceutical marketers now sell drugs by selling the diseases that they treat. And the buzzword is disease branding. We're all on Twitter and Facebook and everything, and we know that we're there to sell something supposedly, or maybe you have another motivation, just friending people and interacting with other people. But a lot of their people there are there to market. And so let's learn more. The brand, to brand a disease is to shape its public perception in order to make it more palatable to potential patients. Panic disorder, reflux disease, erectile dysfunction, restless leg syndrome, bipolar disorder, overactive bladder, ADHD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, even clinical depression. All these conditions were once regarded as rare until a marketing campaign transformed the brand. And on Natural News, Mike Adams also has a cute little application where you can create all these fancy names and branding of illnesses. It's a fun thing, and I'll see if I can give you a link to that. Once a branded disease has achieved a degree of cultural legitimacy, there is no need to convince anyone that a drug to treat it is necessary. It will come to him as his own idea. Disease branding works especially well for two kinds of conditions. The first is the shameful condition that can be destigmatized. For instance, when Pharmacia launched Detrol in the late 1990s, the condition the drug treated was known to doctors as urge incontinence. Patients called it accidentally peeing in my pants and were embarrassed to bring it up with their physicians. Pharmacia fixed the problem by rebranding the condition as, quote, overactive bladder, whereas incontinence suggested weakness and was associated mainly with elderly women. The phrase overactive bladder evoked a supercharged organ frantically trying to working overtime. To qualify for a diagnosis of overactive bladder, patients did not actually have to lose bladder control. They simply needed to go to the bathroom a lot. The vice president of Pharmacia, Neil Wolf, explained the branding strategy in the 2002 presentation called Positioning Detrol, Creating a Disease. By creating the disease of overactive bladder, Wolf claimed Pharmacia created a market of 21 million potential patients. And in this article, the author of the book, White Coat, Black Hat, Dr. Carl Elliott, goes on to give some more examples of how this is done and how we are marketed to and how we look at disease and names of disease now. And there is some more information about that. I will try and provide that for you and the link to this article. And it kind of leads us into our Organon reading for today, which we will go into, aphorism number 95. But I think I'd like to lead up to it with the previous aphorism number 94 to give you an idea. So how contemporary people in the public now view disease, view names of disease, and are we more comfortable with admitting that we have such a thing? And also, how do we look up the disease symptoms? Are we sitting down with a patient and they say to us, I have overactive bladder, I have incontinence. What do they actually say? What are the words that they use? And do they just say, I'm peeing in my pants? And so these are words that we can use as homeopaths, as physicians, to find out what their actual symptoms are and for to help an individual get more in touch and in tune with what is happening in their body. Aphorism number 4 reads, while inquiring into the state of chronic diseases, the particular circumstances of the patient with regard to his ordinary occupations, his usual mode of living, and his diet, his domestic situation, and so forth, must be well considered and scrutinized to ascertain what there is in them that may tend to produce or to maintain disease in order that by their removal the recovery may be promoted. That's the aphorism, and there is a footnote that reads, in chronic diseases of females, it is especially necessary to pay attention to pregnancy, sterility, sexual desire, accouchements, miscarriage, suckling, and the state of the menstrual discharge. With respect to the last named, more particularly, we should not neglect to ascertain if it recurs at too short intervals or is delayed beyond the proper time, how many days it lasts, whether its flow is continuous or interrupted, what is its general quantity, how dark is its color, whether there is leucorrhea before its appearance or after its termination, but especially by what bodily or mental ailments, what sensations and pains it is preceded, accompanied, or followed. If there is leucorrhea, what is its nature? What sensations attend its flow? In what quantity it is? And what are the conditions and occasions under which it occurs? So you can see how very detailed that Hahnemann is asking us to ascertain the information about an individual's chronic state, a condition that a person has lived with for many, many months and years, that they become so accustomed and familiar with living with these symptoms that they kind of relegate it to the back of their mind. They don't want to think about it. They don't want to deal with it. And it just becomes part of the background, sort of background noise for them that they cope with every day or every weekly or monthly, whatever the periodicity of their disease and chronic condition. And so what we're asking a patient to do in a session is to get in touch with this so that we can ascertain the information in order to find a remedy that's going to match their symptoms. And you can see how personal it can get to talk about the colors of discharges, the odors of discharges. And he's giving us specifically examples of female menstruation or pregnancy, miscarriage, things that most likely have an emotional charge to them, not just, you know, the fact that they have to deal with these discharges that occur and what the person thinks of what's happening to them in their own body. And in that way, going back to the previous reading of branding of disease from Dr. Carl Elliott, he's asking in a way, Dr. Carl Elliott is saying that the media and the pharmaceutical companies are asking the public to look at their disease in another way. So whereas a person might consider it shameful, embarrassing, they want to hide what's going on, or they're in shock maybe of what's happened to them during a miscarriage, that these kinds of symptoms and illnesses are just commonplace and that, oh, let's give it a label, let's give it a name, and we'll have a pill for it, and that will take care of your condition. And since everybody's got the same similar kind of condition, you're not alone anymore. Everybody's got it, so don't feel badly about it. Just take this pill and you'll be fine. And that's kind of the marketing that we have today in the pharmaceutical and drug industry. And this is one way that you can kind of get hooked on a drug. Now, let's go back to the aphorism, our reading of the Organon from Dr. Samuel Hahnemann, and see what he says in aphorism number 95. He reads, "In chronic diseases, the investigation of the signs of disease above mentioned and of all others must be pursued as carefully and circumstantially as possible, and the most minute peculiarities must be attended to, partly because in these diseases they are most characteristic and least resemble those of acute diseases. And if a cure is to be effected, they cannot be too accurately noted, partly because the patients become so used to their long sufferings that they pay little or no heed to the lesser accessory symptoms, which are often very pregnant with meaning and characteristic, often very useful in determining the choice of the remedy, and regard them almost as a necessary part of their condition, almost as health, the real feeling of which they have well nigh forgotten in their sometimes 15 or 20 years of suffering, and they can scarcely bring themselves to believe that these accessory symptoms, these greater or lesser deviations from the healthy state, can have any connection with their principal malady." So here he is repeating somewhat of what we've just discussed and talked about, and he's differentiating here the signs of an acute disease, an acute illness, from a chronic illness, which has ongoing symptoms. And when because we know from previous aphorisms that the chronic illness is something that comes on gradually, slowly, over time, gets worse and worse, and degrades the individual's health in a slow manner over years, whereas an acute illness is something more like a life and death situation, like you've fallen off of a cliff and you've broken bones and something has happened to you that you're in shock now, and you know that this is definitely something that needs to be taken care of, and you're acutely aware of what's happening within your body and the drama of that picture of perhaps, let's say, a high fever that's come on suddenly and you are delirious and you are able to explain exactly what's going on, or even an observer could see exactly what's going on for symptoms that are from your healthy state to your diseased state in an acute picture where you can see the person's heat or dryness or delirium or what they're speaking or how they're responding to you and their environment and to this illness that's overtaken them. So here we're saying, Hahnemann is explaining that in a chronic condition, such long sufferings just become something that the person hasn't even put it together, that the way that they're feeling today is related to a unhealthy, non-normal state, that in their normal, healthy state, which should be normal for a person, they would not have such and such symptoms. And we're asking the person to get in touch with that through their case-taking, through the discussion and what he might say interrogation or investigation into the illness, and obtaining as many details, even what you might think is so minute as to the quantity, the color, the periodicity of discharges, where the locations of the pains, the sensations, how, and people don't even understand what we're asking when we say, I understand that this is painful and I understand that this hurts you, but can you give us more information about the exact characteristics and quality, more adjective type words of how we explain this pain, this hurt? And so that's where we want to understand, is it Is it dull? Is it sharp? Is it sticking? Is it? We've gone through many of these descriptions in the past aphorisms, and so these are things that we're looking to hear and understand and get as many words for as possible. And I think that's where we wanted to turn today's session in terms of the aphorisms. I can go back and read a little bit more about Dr. Carl Elliott and see if this follows up well in his article in terms of the branding. So he's explained how if you sell a person on a lifestyle, like everybody needs a music room, and today you know the pharmaceutical industry, when you look at a commercial or an advertising, they're selling a type of lifestyle, a type of personality. They show you a person in a beautiful living room or vacationing at the beach or riding through a field that you're looking very healthy. And so if there's something that they say, this is the way you're going to feel when you take this drug, or this is the type of lifestyle, or even the kind of partner you're going to have. So let's see what else he says in terms of using this branding and the different labels and names, making it very commonplace to destigmatize your illness. He goes on to say, and another good candidate for branding is a condition that can be plausibly portrayed as underdiagnosed. Branding such a condition assures potential patients that they are part of a large and credible community of sufferers. For example, in 1999, the FDA approved the antidepressant Paxil for the treatment of social anxiety disorder, a condition previously known as shyness. And you can look up shyness in the Materia Medica, in the rubrics under shyness, when you're helping someone when they say, I'm shy. In order to convince shy people they had a social anxiety disorder, GlaxoSmithKline, the maker of Paxil, hired a PR firm called Cohn & Wolfe. Cohn & Wolfe put together a public awareness campaign called Imagine Being Allergic to People, which was allegedly sponsored by a group called the Social Anxiety Disorders Coalition. GlaxoSmithKline also recruited celebrities like Ricky Williams, the NFL running back, and paid them to give interviews to the press about their own social anxiety disorder. Finally, they hired academic psychiatrists working on social anxiety disorder and sent them out on the lecture circuit in the top 25 media markets. The results were remarkable. In the 2 years before Paxil was approved for social anxiety, there were only about 50 references to social anxiety disorder in the press. But in 1999, during the PR campaign, there were over a billion, that's with a B, billion references. Within 2 years, Paxil had become the seventh most profitable drug in America, and Cohn & Wolfe had picked up an award for the best PR campaign of 1999. Today, social anxiety disorder, far from being rare, is often described as the third most common mental illness in the world. So you can see what branding has done, how we've found comfort in being in a common situation, common condition with others. And maybe this will be for the good, because then we can talk openly about our symptoms and how we feel. That is the end of today's show. Tomorrow we will go on to read the next aphorisms and talk a little bit more about medicine and the drug companies in America today. And I want to thank everyone for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow. Take care now. Open up your Organon and read it.
Thank you for listening to Who's Reading the Organon with homeopath Debbie Brooke on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio. Remember to take the Organon off the shelf and read it.